My name's Professor Steve Hall, Emeritus Professor of Criminology, formerly of the Universities of Northumbria, Durham, and Teesside, up here in the northeast of England. I worked in criminology departments for over 30 years, but I have a working knowledge of economic history, psychology, sociology, and anthropology, and also some economics and political history also. So my friends call me a polymath. I think that sounds a little highfalutin, but I'm just a thinker who's a jack of all trades, master of none, and barely make jack in some dimensions, I'm sure.
Well, look, people try to specialise, and this is totally understandable, but I do feel an affinity with this. In journalism, I think, you've got to have some sort of working knowledge of all sorts of different areas. Otherwise, you can be bamboozled. One of the main things I think we need to just understand now is how this whole concept of the mixed economy. Now, you and I are old enough to remember a functioning economy, a mixed economy, which I'm not sure what the proportions were, whether it was one third or two thirds. No, I think it was around about a third of the economy was based on public sector, which was owned by the government. The infrastructure was nationally owned, whatever it happened to be, whether it's water, gas, transport, buses, trains, all these things, even road transport for a long time was. With British Ro Road, I think it was called British Road Services. So there was a massive, massive nationalisation at the end of the Second World War by the Labour government, and that was what we were brought up with. And it meant that people would often decide, look, I want to have a career in the private sector with a good pay, lots of money, or I'll go into the public sector, which is generally better job security, solid pension, this sort of thing. And but maybe less pay in the public sector. So, and I'm actually scraping around these days, Steve, to even find anyone who's a public servant. So that, to me, is one of the most enormous changes. And actually, none of the modern political parties seem to be addressing the fact that you need to have a decent public sector. Number one, for there to be any point in voting. And number two, in order to keep the cost of living down. So can you just say, what it's almost like whatever happened to the public sector?
I think we have to understand that period from 1945 through 1979 as a blip in commercial history of Europe and, of course, America, that stretches back to the 11th century Venice and England, when William the First gave his financial advisors the square mile, and when the Venetian traders from Venice, Florence, and Genoa were creating the commercial trajectory that Europe would follow. And so that few years, that 3 decades, was just a blip in a long history. When we had a functioning economy, we had a public sector that worked for the public good, for public purpose. Now we still have a public sector, of course, but it works for a captured state, a state captured by global finance, which must work under the discipline of global finance. We've talked about this before, bond, currency and stock markets, of course, how they discipline states. Asian financial crisis triggered by sell-offs on the currency market, and it could affect the whole continent. So the state now works for private finance. We see this in the meetings of Dean Rachel and Larry Fink and these private equity managers trying to woo private investment in the country. Of course, public investment crowds out private investment, they say, but I don't believe that it does. In fact, it would change the nature of private investment, but I don't think it would crowd it out, and certainly hasn't done that in China. And it didn't do that in Europe during that period. There was, as you say, a reasonable balance. So it was a blip. The Keynesian welfare state was with us for a few decades. People had a better time. There were pay conditions, public services were better, things were more relaxed and more exciting. The 60s was a far more creative and exciting era than we're experiencing now. But that wasn't what the powers to be wanted. That wasn't what the financiers and the big capitalists and corporations wanted. They want privatized economies. They want a return to that commercial trajectory that characterized the 900 years before that tiny little blip.
Is it just that the modern political parties and the press have just forgotten about this, Steve?
Have they forgotten about the Keynesian? Well, no, far from it. When we hear Mark Carney talking about a possible reversal or a possible change in direction, you can hear echoes of the old Keynesian state. You have various strands of Keynesianism in academic, in economics departments, new Keynesian, post-Keynesianism. And you can sense there's this hankering back to a better period. Now, this has been precipitated to some extent by the success of China, which is operating a quasi-Keynesian economy controlled by what you can only call as a Leninist central state. Although we must, we must accept the fact that the Chinese Communist Party has 3,000 members, which represent local and regional zones. So there is a core democracy there, if the Chinese people can trust their representatives. There is a very strong core democratic element. So it's not this authoritarian monster portrayed by the Western press. So China's success and its industrial success, its purchasing power, parity of the workers, they're getting more for their money, lifting billions out of poverty, building bridges in the sky. They're ahead in all sorts of technological fields. They're catching up in the making of processors and chips. And they're doing incredibly well, far better in a lot of ways than we have, and all within the space of a few decades from the late 70s. So we're hankering back to this, and even the most even the most fervent neoliberals are starting to think again that there must be a better way of doing things. So no, it hasn't disappeared, but whatever we do, it has to be in an updated form. Because we're in a completely different situation now where we've hived off manufacturing to the Far East. We can't bring back all of the manufacturing that we've given away. So we have to think about developing manufacturing to the extent we can and combining that with the service economy, with properly funded services, public and private.
Who is it that's flicked this switch? I mean, somebody must have done that says industry is going to move from the UK to China. I mean, was it just that we had greedy financiers here in Britain who forced Thatcher to flog off all the family silver to them?
Well, it was a legacy of empire, I think. And don't forget that, from the early merchant adventurers in the time of Queen Elizabeth I, the Tudor times, taking their lead from the Mediterranean city-states, the Mediterranean traders, wanted to put their capital anywhere they want. That's what the whole thing is about. They don't want to be restricted where they invest their money. So this, again, is a very long tradition. The British Empire was simply a means of investing money wherever they wanted in, the imperial territories and later the Sterling area, of course. So it's a harking back to a right, principal economic right to invest your money where you're going to get the highest returns. So rather than simply greedy individuals, although there are a lot of them around, of course, this is a systemic thing and it's a normative thing. That's the way people think. It's a right, an inalienable right to invest your money where you're going to get the highest returns, to get the highest return on your asset. So, which is in this case is reserve capital, is money that's spare dosh to invest. So it goes back an awful long way. And yes, they hated the Keynesian period principally because of capital controls. Now, we've spoken about this before, the way they used the Eurodollar market in the 1950s to circumvent these controls. China employs a certain amount of capital exchange controls in order to make sure that some domestic investment is targeted to its own industries and infrastructure. So again, that's anathema to globalists who want to basically put their money where they want. So yes, greedy individuals combined with a set of norms and values in a system that wants simply to keep on going the way it has done for a very long time.
So Andy Roberts from Fine Print YouTube channel last week explained very, very concisely. Actually, it was quite a long piece. It's about 10, 15 minutes or so. But China now controls and owns much of our gas and electricity infrastructure. Now, I can't imagine the Chinese allowing a City of London financial institutions to do a hostile takeover, even a friendly takeover of their energy infrastructure.
Or a friendly partnership. Try them and see. Because this is part of the Chinese way of doing things. Whether they would object to partial public ownership or full public ownership if they were bought out, I don't know. The Chinese don't want to upset people. They don't want to take over infrastructure. The deals that African countries are getting, for instance, and BRICS nations are getting for China are very good deals. No strings attached, low interest, and very, very good repayment terms. So I think China's giving the world, and I think this is really upsetting the American Wall Street and the City of London, because they're actually out-competing them in at their own game by giving by offering better deals. So I don't know what the Chinese would say if there was a move to go into partnership on in the utilities that they're investing in, and to find investment partners, and some of which would be from the central bank, the public sector. I don't know. So let's try them and see.
Well, they do seem to be fairly straight dealers. Certainly, much more, much straighter than the West. This whole Epstein release at the end of January, beginning of February 2026, has really kind of put the cat amongst the pigeons to a certain extent. I wonder if you could just tell me, answer a couple of aspects of this. One is, what do you think was going on with Ghislaine Maxwell and Jeffrey Epstein? And secondly, about the fallout with people like Mandelson actually now being arrested.
Well, I think that we've had Jacob Rees-Mogg on social media agreeing with Mandelson's arrest, some people claiming that he was implicated in it. And this shows, I think, that you have to suspect, don't we, that people like Mandelson, Epstein, and even Maxwell, although I think Maxwell's quite high up in the asset hierarchy, higher than Epstein, certainly because she recruited him. I think that they're being used as scapegoats, because I think the whole system is rotten. The new term has entered the lexicon, hasn't it? The Epstein class. I think that the Epstein class does signify an incredibly narcissistic, entitled class. We're seeing other examples of this in people like Peter Thiel, Elon Musk, Donald Trump, and all over the world, Milei in Argentina, people in Eastern Europe, guy who's just bought the post office, I think it's Czechoslovakian, isn't he? Sorry, Czech Republic, from the Czech Republic. I'm old-fashioned, I still think Czechoslovakian. I'll be talking about Yugoslavia. I'm describing
an oligarchy.
A global oligarchy, represented by this rather manipulative Epstein class, who know how to operate in all sorts of institutions, mass media, finance, politics, and to make sure this continues. And we're looking again, and I have to say this, we're looking at a restoration. The French philosopher Alain Badiou, sorry, I'm getting mixed up again, not Bourdieu, Alain Badiou, called this the restoration. It's a restoration of a power that goes back to the 11th century. This is commercialism, the power of commercialism that displaced religion and landed aristocracy as the leaders, the economic, financial, and political leaders of Europe and the West. So we're seeing a restoration of this power in a modern tech-enhanced form, which is really, I think, rather scary when you talk about people like Nick Land, Peter Thiel, accelerationism, transhumanism, looking to, I think, Yanis Varoufakis calls it techno-feudalism. I think it's actually beyond feudalism. I think Yanis is getting that, maybe slightly understating it. I think it's Olympian. I think that these people don't see themselves simply as the new landed aristocrats, where their territory is what the market's shares of cyberspace they can command, but they're seeing themselves as Olympian, that they're almost godlike, that they can play around with people, play around with their emotions, play around with their desires and their visions as much as they want in order to remain in their incredibly entitled, wealthy, powerful positions, which they're getting more powerful and richer all the time. If you look at the stats from America, where you see that the wealth gap has been expanding for decades now. So we're looking at something very, very dangerous, narcissistic, and very, very ancient. You know, we see this in the ancient world, where the Axial Age, which replaced the collapse of the Bronze Age, was the age where the great religions, revealed religions, were beginning to form themselves right across the Middle East, from China across to the Levant. And they were beginning to have an effect. They were beginning to look down upon ordinary people trying to get on together in this terrible collapse after the Bronze Age, very, very violent, chaotic, dark age. And they were finding ways of getting on together. They were constructing new norms, new values, new practices, new relationships. And the revealed religions, the first prophets and philosophers, started to draw upon these practical steps that were being taken to create this new movement towards a moral society. Of course, that was kiboshed by Hellenism and the Greeks and the Romans, who abandoned the debt jubilee and abandoned all these noble ideas. And, you know, Alexander and his Macedonian thugs going over and sacking Persepolis and taking over the place, and then the Romans. We saw this Olympian ideals where emperors and rich landowners considered themselves to be godlike. And I think this is where we're going back to that now. And I think this is incredibly dangerous. And there are some philosophers who have connections, of course, to the European haute bourgeoisie. Their mothers, fathers and relations had executive positions in corporations, for instance, who see an acceleration towards this as as a good thing. Is that the right word?
I think that's what they'd say. I mean, this old school friend of mine, Nick Land, Nazi Nick, back in 2017, he was up in Dalston's LD50 gallery, doing a talk. And it turns out that actually a load of anti-fascists turned up outside it. Holding signs like "Nazi hipsters F off," and "White supremacy F off," "Nazi scum," and this sort of thing. And the LD50 gallery, when it was doing his talk, their website was been taken down, their Twitter account deleted afterwards, and in fact the gallery closed. So, I mean, all he's doing there, this is Nick, just giving a talk along with this. I think it's the Guardian's art critic, Jonathan Jones, criticised the protesters. Yeah. And what he says, that this was a pathetic attack on free speech. So, I mean, I just find Nick a very interesting character, someone I used to know. And it seems that people like Yuval Noah and Harari, well, they do. They openly say they do. And Elon Musk, he's out of his hand.
Well, I think so. And I think it was very perceptive of the protest to see that they sort of moved towards hipster Nazism. I saw all sorts of quite extreme left-wing figures, like Sadie Plant, people like that, being drawn into the new accelerationist dimension, this new dimension of philosophy that was opening up in the 1990s.
Well, we ought to say something about the Cybernetic Culture Research Unit at Warwick University, which Nick started, which was a sort of the very early days of the internet, and the idea was, isn't this brilliant? And he was trying to put forward a vision for the future of the internet and say, well, this is a great liberating thing.
Absolutely. Well, this godlike control of communication, control of images, control of the way we think and feel about the world is you know.
But that's not how he pitched it, Steve. I mean,
that's ultimately what it is.
Well,
about.
Okay, but he was pitching the whole thing as, we must be out there. You know, alternative thinkers have got to be online. Don't let the big companies take it over. That's how it was pitched.
I think that was it might have started out like that, but of course, as soon as you talk about freedom and power coming together like that, you're talking about oligarchy, not about democracy. In fact, TL has recently spoken out against democracy. He thinks democracy's had its day. We've entered a new period, which is, rather like a rerun of the Weimar Republic, where democracy is faltering, and we need strong leaders, strong, powerful, wealthy leaders who are super intelligent, who have their hands on the latest technology, and they're going to save us all and move us all into. And if you can't keep up with this, then you simply drop off the edge. You're gone. And I think that really is talking about the bulk of the working and lower middle classes who can simply go to hell. They
Well,
don't
look, the
care about
mainstream press doesn't really explain this at all, even though I think it's a very important, influential, powerful philosophy. Nick himself is very against this idea of democracy. He thinks people just get it wrong the whole time, and you can actually have some sympathy with him there, and that actually what needs to run things is capital. It's just wherever the money goes, wherever it's making more money, wherever it's successful, then that's the what we should follow. We should just do what the profits indicate is the best thing to do. But anyway, so maybe you could just
But
talk about this. Sorry, go on.
this is the problem. If you look at the Axial Age and that long period of 500 years before Hellenization, what you find is that it's exactly the opposite. It's that ordinary people have the answers. They have the answers in their everyday interactions, where they're pretty nice with each other. They help each other out. There's a lot of mutual aid going on. It used to be called neighborliness. Do you remember? It used to be called being a good neighbor, being decent with each other. I was brought up in the labor aristocracy. I was brought up in the coal mining village near a steel town, where steel workers and coal miners. And there were a few ruffians amongst them at the bottom of that pile. But I grew up amongst the most decent people I've ever met in my life. And we helped each other out, a lot of mutual aid. Bonhomie, good cheer. Remember these terms? It was the secret is down there at the bottom, where no one is allowed to look in everyday life.
Well, look, what you're talking about really here is the extension of family values into the wider community.
Which was cut off in the 12th century by the incursion of the laws of primogeniture and entail throughout the social structure, first in England and then throughout Europe, which actually turned family members into rivals over the favour of the parents and the
It's just to
parents'
do with
estate.
inheritance.
Yes. There's a change in the inheritance laws, primogeniture, yeah. Some very interesting historical work being done about that by numerous people, including myself. This is at the bottom of this commercialisation process that's turning family and communities into atomised competitive individuals, and which fueled the urbanisation process and which fueled early merchant capitalism, of course.
You know what your pop what's popping into my head as you say this is the current situation here in Bristol with the travellers. I mean, we've got hundreds, probably about 800 people living in vehicles, many of whom they're just there because they cannot afford to pay the rent. They've been evicted. This is the only sort of, in fact, one of them on the Sky News report this week or last week was saying. Actually, I feel like now I've got a vehicle, I've got my foot on the housing ladder. Because this is how desperate people are for housing, and it's and what the council have been doing. I mean, it fits in exactly what you with, seems to me with what you're saying about history. Really, is that over the decades, travellers have collected and found bits of derelict land, often public land or former public land, where they've gathered in, say, maybe 60 or 70 vehicles and caravans. They've lived there for free. The council have, over the last couple of years since COVID, been evicting these sites, putting these people onto the curbs, basically, around roads, around the city. Now, it's very much then in your face as a public menace. At least that's what the press and some pressure groups and the Daily Mail are saying. And now they're saying, well, you can go back to these old sites that you used to live on. It's just that you now have to pay us rent and council tax, Band A council tax. So it seems to me this whole idea that the earth is a free gift to mankind, or the commons are there for everyone and anyone, is going. Everything is now, it seems, about private ownership of land.
Yes, that's been gone since the late 14th century, the beginning of the Enclosure Acts. But after the plague, an awful lot of land was lying fallow because families died off and then they couldn't farm. So there was a huge opportunity for these people flooding out of their old families, running away from hostile, what had become financial relationships with each other rather than loving family relationships, into the urban areas and then into the rural areas looking for land to farm, commercial land. So land was enclosed, fenced off. And the idea that there's a commons that began to disappear. Of course, the Enclosure Acts accelerated during the 16th, 17th, 18th centuries. And now the whole idea that there's anything that free land or common land is anathema. And land is under private ownership. And it's a form of basic rentierism, isn't it? You know, land is there to be owned and rented out rather than the old system of tenant farmers. You have this system where you simply have to buy your own land, or you have to rent it from private. And let's face it, the councils now are simply private capitalist organisations. Municipal socialism died about 40 years ago too. So they're just private renters, local authorities are businesses now, aren't they? And so the whole idea of the commons has disappeared. And the whole idea of the family is now a competitive unit. They try to love each other as much as they can, and I'm sure some of them succeed, but at the end of the day, they're forced to compete. So this is what these new philosophers want to accelerate. I think Peter Thiel said it quite recently. He said he doesn't like democracy. The fundamental reason he hates democracy is that it interferes with his freedom and his property rights. He wants to be able to accumulate as much property, as many assets, both tangible and intangible, in terms of land, buildings, and also financial assets and stocks and shares, etc., as he can. He wants the right to simply accumulate, to be virtually unlimited. And this, again, is this sort of godlike thing, isn't it? You know, they simply want to own the world. As I remember, with my criminological hat on, looking at the mindset of the Ian Brady, the serial killer who, as a young child, walked to the top of a hill in Scotland and looked out on the territory, and said to his foster parents at the time, "I want to own this. This is mine. This is my territory. I want this to be able to do anything I want in this territory." And this is what privatism is about. It's the freedom to do anything you want in your privately owned space. And there are no real limits. The limits, I think, the jury's out on whether the Marquis de Sade was satirizing this or actually celebrating it. It's difficult to make that decision, really. But certainly, to go beyond good and evil in Nietzsche's terms, simply do what you want. Foucault, the postmodern philosopher, although I think he balks at the title postmodern, he's part of the postmodernist movement, celebrated extreme experiences. You're not alive unless you're experiencing the most extreme things you can imagine. And this, I think, is behind transhumanism, behind accelerations, this dream of unlimited experience and unlimited gratification, which really drives, is driving us to a very bad place, Tony.
Yeah, so let's just look at Mandelson for a minute. I mentioned him earlier, but the idea that he's now been arrested, I mean, I don't know whether you think that the criminal process will unfold fairly, honestly, with somebody like him who has such important connections to the elites and the oligarchy and the crown and the City of London. What's his role been in the Labour movement since? I mean, I think he was an advisor to Kinnock, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. Yes, and I think that this is simply a entryism. I think it's infiltration of the Labour movement by principally Zionists and other forces who want to simply t- to turn the Labour movement from being a left-wing movement into being a centrist or a slightly centre-right liberal movement, so that the old Keynesian welfare state could be dismantled, that we could move away from public ownership and public investment into and fully embrace privatisation. Now, Blair accelerated deindustrialisation, and by the 90s, after the death of John Smith, who was, I think, the last of the Mohicans, when I came, the last of the old democratic socialists in the Labour Party, when he died, Blair took over the leadership. I think we saw the last of the old, as I say, democratic socialists, and we moved into this period where Blair accelerated deindustrialisation, accelerated financialisation. Brown further loosened the regulations on the City of London financiers, if you remember, along with Clinton, of course, around about the same time as Clinton did. And they started looking for balanced budgets. Clinton managed to balance the budget in 1999, 2000. Guess what? A recession in 2001 because it was shrinking the money supply. So they simply want to their principal aim is to diminish the power of the public sector, public finance, public ownership as much as they possibly can, and privatise everything they possibly can.
Well, look, you mentioned John Smith there. Very few people do. He was an extremely able leader of the opposition. And he would make Margaret Thatcher, and I think it was John Major too, if I've got my timing right, look rather stupid in the House of Commons week after week with rather witty riposts. You know, he was extremely good speaker, could think on his feet and mock them wonderfully. And wasn't it peculiar the way he popped off? He disappeared. He died. There were some people that questioned whether this was a natural death or whether he was helped out of the way. But it was an absolutely brilliant little red carpet for a certain Tony Blair to take over. I mean,
we can question all what seem like convenient deaths. Unfortunately, we might never know. We might be able to nail some down and find the smoking gun and find the culprit. But for most of them, we probably never know. It sounded like it might have been a natural death to me because he was suffering from a rather serious heart condition, wasn't he?
Well, Alex Salmond as well is another one. You know, people just sort of pop off in their prime, but they it always seems to be the ones that are more socialist, and these are the ones.
Yes,
that disappear.
I mean, we can be as conspiratorial as we like about that, but like I say, just find, you know, the hard evidence is very hard to come out. I keep an open mind about everything, you know, either the official or the alternative narratives. So you have to keep your own mind, don't you? Keep your mind open, you know, same with 9/11 and everything. Have an open mind about
Robin Cook, I should mention.
Robin Cook, another one, I think in the old days, they were more overt about it, weren't they? I mean, they shot Kennedy and they tried to shoot Roosevelt, FDR, 16 days or was it 17 days before his inauguration. So they're literally a little bit more overt about it. They shot Lincoln and Garfield and they were quite happy bumping people off. The public didn't seem to be bothered by it because of gun-toting country in Latin America. We are less gun-toting, of course, so they have to do it more subtly. But, yeah, it's possible. I don't know. But the fact is that Smith was the last of the old democratic socialists. And then we found the Labour Party basically becoming a neoliberal party from that period onwards. And the acceleration that these accelerationists are talking about was organic already. It was the whole system was already accelerating into a privatised, high-tech, globalised and quite deranged period of history where we were leaving behind the traditional norms that governed all sorts of things from sexuality through to economics and everyday relationships. They were all being cast aside. It's a personal experimentation seemed to be the order of the day. That seemed very exciting and very it seemed that we were setting ourselves free, but I'm not sure that we did anything good with our freedom in the end.
Well, maybe we weren't given the opportunity. We weren't given the space to do it. We weren't given the common space to do it. that much of this space where activity can happen, particularly, you know, financially fueled, as it needs that financial fuel to get on with it, has been completely reined in. But look, I just want to finish with a throwback to this demonstration in February 2017 at LD50 Studio in Dalston, Tottenham Road, because this Nazi hipsters F off. Now, you've got the guy from The Guardian saying, look, it's just free speech. Where do you stand on that?
Where do I stand on the protection of free speech above all?
Well, is it? Yeah, I mean, it is. I mean, what this crowd are saying is we don't want the accelerationists, the Dark Enlightenment people, to have their free speech.
No, I think they were saying that they don't want the Dark Enlightenment people to be in the hall. And they're quite at liberty to say that, to protest and outside protest. As long as they don't pick them up by the collar and throw them out, then they're not committing any crime. So it was a vocal protest in the public domain, and both sides were protesting, I'm sure.
Yeah, but Steve, are they using this term Nazi? They're not saying they're neo-Nazis, they're not saying they're far right, they're saying they're Nazis.
Well, it's freedom of speech. They think they're Nazis. That's the term they use, the category they use. I don't know. Well, I haven't investigated this lot in the detail I would need to decide whether they're Nazis or neo-Nazis, or whether they're simply rather deranged futurists. Probably more like the Italian futurists than the Nazis.
But okay,
I don't know. That's freedom of speech. It goes. It cuts both ways.
So where do you think?
People want to stand outside
think,
and shout. Where, I mean, if people want to stand outside and shout at these people, then they're free to do so.
Well, where do you think Thiel and Land are taking us?
I think Thiel and Land are taking us into a potential dystopia, in which this entitled godlike. See, we have this concept in ultra-realism, the research movement that I'm part of, called special liberty, where people who have achieved huge success in finance, high tech, or whatever is fashionable, whatever is moving the capitalist system forward, or seen to be moving it forward at a particular time, feel so entitled that they take on board godlike self-identities. They identify as almost godlike. We saw that in the 19th century, people like Cecil Rhodes, etc., and with the Rockefellers and in America and all the rest of it, and the industrialists. But I think they were more committed to communities. We see, you know, Lord Armstrong in Newcastle, you know, constructed parks, schools and all sorts of things. So more community, a little bit more noblesse oblige amongst that group. This lot simply want total freedom. They want to ride on the top of this wave and look down upon the rest of us and simply do what they want, accumulate what they want, and enjoy life to the absolute limits, while the rest of us are simply slaving away, shining their shoes and making their meals when they need us to do that, you know, before machines replace that, even that. I think they're talking about AI dentistry, and that is the next move, isn't it? So, yeah, I think they're taking us to a dystopia. I think it's worse than techno-feudalism. I think it's worse than Nazism. I think this is Olympian. I think we can call it Olympian, that we're heading towards a Hellenized sort of Olympian culture presided over by people who wish us no real goodwill at all.
It may be just simply that they're drunk on power. They've got power. They want more and more, and it's never enough. It's like heroin.
Well, that's what I'm saying, but I think that this has precedence, and I think that this has a sort of imagery, a self-imagery, which is almost godlike, which is even more different, but even more dangerous, because don't forget godlike power is the power over life and death.
Yeah, and with Nietzsche, who Nick was very much into when I knew him, you've got this whole idea of beyond good and evil going. You mentioned that, actually. And this idea of,
in a sense, I mean, Nietzsche was the son of a Protestant pastor. And this goes back to the idea of Protestant's notion that God doesn't exist up there in the firmament, in the heavens, and his word is passed down to us through institutions like the Catholic Church, but God dwells inside all of us. God is simply the title used for the conscience, the individual's conscience, the individual's goodwill. And this idea that God's inside all of us can, I think, have very, very dangerous repercussions. And I think Protestantism had nothing to do with Christianity. I think it was a move away from Christianity. And I think that Nietzsche was the son of a Protestant pastor. What he expected, in a sense, was almost too trusting of individual, in the sense that he thought they could move beyond the slave morality, as he called it, move beyond the norms, values that had been of good and evil, the Manichaean values that had been forced on people, and move beyond that and create their own morality, create their own practice, create their own cultures. So he was very much into the sort of creative spirit of the individual. Now, everyone says Nietzsche's misunderstood, but I also think that the people who say Nietzsche is misunderstood are also misunderstanding them, because I think there was both quite an evil part, an evil aspect to his thinking that we don't really fully understand, because I don't think that, I think there's almost a naivety that can explode in our faces about the human spirit and the conscience. And the idea that we always wish for the best. Was the character in Voltaire's novel who was the best of all possible worlds, wasn't it? You know, I've forgotten the name of the character. There's almost a naivety about him. And I think there's a naivety about us as we look upon this tech, the unfolding of this tech, so-called utopia. And I think that it could turn very dystopian very quickly. Already India, for instance, has put all its... Well, not all of it, but an awful lot of its effort into creating a tech service industry. Now, because it didn't develop the industrial base that was put there in the Licensed Raj era before 1991, they didn't develop the industrial manufacturing and innovative capabilities of tech that the likes of America and China have. So they're reliant on tech services. Now, AI could steam in there and completely kibosh that project, leaving India again in a very powerless condition, because they also failed to invest in their agricultural sector of the economy. So it could be quite dangerous. AI could replace all sorts of jobs, leave people jobless. What happens to jobless people in the absence of the old socialist project, in the absence of a representative, their political representatives? They can go whichever way they feel, can't they? They can go to the far right, they can even join this accelerationist nonsense. And they can watch charlatans on YouTube, and be drawn into almost any sort of daft set of ideas. So it could be incredibly dystopian. We don't know how it's going to go. We don't know how we're going to regulate it. But we do need to look at this very hard, and we do need to consider the dystopian possibilities.
Is it possible to fight back against this so-called inevitable techno tyranny that all of our governments and elites seem to have bought into?
Without violence? I think we can fight back by pressing home and throughout the education system the uniqueness of human values and human creativity. I think that to some extent is happening, and some of the better informed and more morally driven technologists themselves are starting to have second thoughts about the whole thing, and they're starting to reveal, for instance, AI for what it is. It's just a very fast search engine. It doesn't think. It uses cliches to tie bits of information together and give you them in a chunk that looks like someone thinking it through and giving you a little lecture, doesn't it? You know, if you ask DeepSeek or ChatGPT about something, if you know how to quiz it, if you have knowledge of the subject and you know how to quiz it, you can actually force it to change its mind. So what all it is a fast search engine. It's not really thinking at all. And I think technologists are now coming to the conclusion that it will never be able to think. Some are claiming that at some point it will develop a real artificial human-like intelligence. I don't think so. A lot of technologists don't think so. So what we can do is press home that the joys of human creativity. I've just joined a well-known blues band. I play blues and jazz guitar up in the northeast here, from a time when creativity was coming out of the from the bottom of a racist American society, producing beautiful music and blues and jazz. And I think anyone who doesn't think that's beautiful is absent of a soul. And it's truly unique, truly beautiful. I love doing it. And I think that's what we can create. That's what can come up from the bottom. I go back to the Axial Age. It's looking at what people are doing in everyday life. That's where the secrets are. And that's what we've got to uncover again. And we've got to take these practices, ideas, these values from the bottom and create institutions that represent that rather than institutions that represent this rather out of control techno, Olympian techno trajectory that we're on now, which I think could lead us into serious trouble.
Yeah, so there was a 1975 children's TV series called The Changes on the BBC, which it was in ways amazingly prescient. I can remember rushing back from school to watch it because it was really good. And this was all about destruction of technology. So the idea was that people suddenly started finding everything technological evil. In fact, there was even like a technological witch finder in the drama series. I don't think they'd be putting that out for the kids nowadays, but I mean, in a way, it was really prescient, this concept that technology is whatever it is the people that own it control. Absolutely. It's a bit like going back to the days of the Luddites, you know, seeing all these machines coming into the countryside and making them jobless, etc. So we're in a similar sort of situation.
Oh, I'm partial to a bit of Luddism. I mean, that's fine with me. You know, I'm reminded of the Ballad of John Henry, this huge guy who beat the riveting machine on the railroads, you know, but died of a heart attack because he was trying to beat the machine. And I think that spirit of John Henry is with us all. And I think it's a common sci-fi theme, isn't it? We start with Mary Shelley, Frankenstein, through to the robots, through to Asimov, all the rest of these, the machines, and of course Kubrick's 2001. The machines, computers are going to take over our lives. We don't trust them. They're too much input by people whose intentions don't seem to be particularly good, and they could take us into a bad place. We need to revive that culture. I think it was most beautifully done, but Dennis Potter's, one of his latter plays, it was called Cold Lazarus, which was, I think, broadcast on the BBC in the 1980s. And I think we need to go back to realise the beauty of an organic life, an creative organic cultural lives, and we need to start emphasising that in our education system, our mass media, and start criticising these technologists and these machines. The tradition is there. The tradition of doing that, we have a 200-year tradition of doing that, and I think we can build on that and start to bring it back. We start to become more questioning, more critical, and start celebrating our own human qualities a lot more in our education and in the way we bring up our children.
And also integrate it into the anti-fascist tradition.
I think so. It was always part of the anti-fascist tradition, the idea of organic. But the problem is that when organic life starts to be poisoned by commercialism and, you know, starts to push past its normative limits, it starts to celebrate things like paedophilia, for instance, celebrate things that are outside of universal taboos, and organic culture itself is poisoned. We have to bring that back. If that means making it more wholesome, does it? Well, maybe that is what we need to do, and that we need to bring back a far more wholesome, creative, organic culture, which can feed into the way our children think and feel about the world.
Okay, Steve, just if you could just give us your X handle, Elon Musk's, one of his little acolytes, I believe you are.
Oh, I don't know. Acolyte, well, I balk at that name, Tony, but I do have an X account. I rabbit on about economics and some people. I think I have a knack of explaining complex stuff quite in accessible terms. I did that for a living for a long time. And you're quite welcome to have a look at that. And I think I'm at ProfHall55 on X. You don't have to suffer my weird little Geordie, semi-Geordie accent on there, you know.
So, I mean, it's interesting what you say there, because Epstein himself, I just finish on this, because the account that he gives in the interview with Steve Bannon is amazing, really. He talks about, he's saying that the Wall Street is actually very simple, the whole way it operates. But he's saying that they use all these terms. He runs through a whole load of terms to do with stock trading and economics, where he's basically saying this is all just used to befuddle the public, and all the journalists go along with it. And actually, it's what they do is really, really simple.
Of course, it's jargonized nonsense. What they're doing is betting on bonds, stocks, and currencies, and central bank interest rates. That's all they're doing. It's a gambling den, very sophisticated gambling den. And what they're trying to do, if you read the, you know, ex-City traders, people like Tony Northfield, even Gary Stevenson, even though I don't like his writing style, or whoever was his ghostwriter or whatever, it's they're trying to simply second-guess the market. So the market is their master. They're sitting there trying to second-guess what the herd mentality of the market will do next. That's no way to run life. That's no way to run an economy. Not at all. This has to go. And we have to start looking, again, at public investment. BRICS are moving away from this. They're moving away quite rapidly at the moment. Whether they'll get there or not, I don't know, because the Americans are... Americans can do quite evil things in terms of regime change, four-stage regime change, you know, first financial attacks, then sanctions, and then organizing coups and finally military invasion. That's quite an evil empire, and they might try to put a stop to all this, but let's hope they don't, and let's hope that the world does change. The more intelligent neoliberals like Mark Carney are starting to understand that now. So let's hope we just get a little bit of goodwill and help from where we least expect it.
The 500 billion euro bailout email that that Mandelson sent while he was, I mean, she's, you know, now being investigated for, this seems to me to be exactly the sort of thing which the Epstein class, the Maxwell class, need in order to keep their little money spinning going. And they're gambling. Of course, this is insider dealing. It's saying, well, this is what the market's going to be doing tomorrow. So it seems to me that this is absolute evidence that people like Mandelson are just in there for that purpose.
Yes, the whole Epstein class have been riding on the back of commercial financial school degree since the 11th century, since the Rialto money market. And they've been doing it ever since. It's incredibly enriching in the financial sense. And, of course, it allows them to buy politicians. They even bought into the Catholic Church with the Borgias and the Medicis. We all know that. And they can infiltrate all institutions by simply buying their way into them and buying, funding politicians' campaigns. I mean, the politicians we have these days aren't running anything, you know. They're simply doing what they're told to do by Wall Street and the City.
Oh, do you have your price, Mr. Steve Hall?
My price is to be left alone to play my blues guitar and jazz guitar and not to have to partake in any of this and yet still retain a reasonably comfortable existence. That's the only price I have. The idea that myself and people like me admire even any of these people, that's what rankles. I mean, they're the least... I have no admiration whatsoever for any of these people. I have a loving family, reasonably comfortable. I do things I enjoy doing, and I live my life. And I think that our ambitions need to change, our visions need to change. And if we can create a more create a culture in which these values are put to the, you know, are put before wealth, commerce, and status seeking, driving around in these awful, horrible, oversized what do they call them? You know, these Chelsea tractors, you know, these SUVs. God almighty. I mean, how much bigger do they have to get, you know, before people feel as though they have enough status? I'm fed up with it. A lot of people are just fed up with the whole thing, and they would like to live in a culture that has more organic values and values that are pointing in other directions. We're fed up with it. And the more people are fed up with it, the better.
Okay, Steve Hall, thanks very much for joining us.
Okay, thank you.